Welcome back to Ashburton. We're about ready to start now.
It's political commentary.
This morning with Rod Oram. Morena, Rod, how are you?
Morena, Rachel, very well, thank you.
It's good to chat to you this morning. We're going to talk a wee bit about the Climate Change Commission's report and all of the conversation around electric vehicles this morning. Also have a conversation about what's happening up north with the SNAs and the big hikoi that we've seen in the last week. But first, I think we should touch on the fact that the government has said that they are going to formally apologise for the dawn raids, which has been something, I guess, long pushed for by activists and by communities. And now we are seeing this. How do you feel about this? I mean, I think it's long overdue is generally the consensus, but what are your thoughts?
Indeed, long overdue and completely appropriate. In each generation, we do things that in hindsight we shouldn't have done, and we should have known better at the time. This is one of them, and it's all part of our process of being able to learn, put right the extent you can after you've created so much havoc in people's lives a long time ago. So then we are hopefully better tuned into what we're doing today that we need to do better. And I was trying to do a little mental exercise of what I think we'll be apologizing for in a generation or two. And I'm not sure what that is, other than quite certainly not responding to the climate crisis fast enough. So yes, this is all part of a very right process in society.
Well, let's talk about climate change then. We've seen the final report from the Climate Change Commission, and electric vehicles has been, I guess, the hot button topic in the media, particularly around this rebate scheme. Can you just explain briefly what is the rebate scheme going to look like and why is it getting so much attention?
The idea behind the rebate scheme is that we have one of the least fuel efficient, one of the most polluting fleets of cars in the world and one of the oldest. So we need to move that fleet on, obviously ultimately to zero emissions. A very important way to do that is to incentivize the take up of more fuel efficient cars. So this isn't just about EVs. They attract the biggest rebate, the biggest price discount at one end. But coming back down the line through hybrid cars and others, you will get declining amount of money because they are saving less fuel. But at the other end of the scale, cars and light vehicles that use a great deal of fuel, they get hit with an extra fee. And so roughly speaking, it's about the top end of the fee. It's I've forgotten the number. I think it's about 3,000 or 4,000. I might be wrong on that. At the top end of the rebate, it's about 8,600. But this inevitably raises the question of, well, what about tradies and farmers who can't have electric vehicles? That's true at this point. But we've already got one hybrid, we've got several hybrid SUVs in the market already. The Mitsubishi Outlander is actually an all-electric one, and there's others. And then if you're looking at tradies, Ford fairly recently introduced a hybrid transit van here, and they're going to have an electric version of that next year. LDV, which is a Chinese-made vehicle, have a very good van that's all electric already in the country, and there's all sorts of second-hand electric options. But even if you don't want to go electric, if you pause to think about, should I be buying a vehicle with a better fuel consumption, what would my options be? So I hope that this will get people going to, for example, the very excellent total cost of ownership interactive tool on the Gen Less website, where you can plug in choice of cars and see what the total cost of ownership of that is, including if it's a high fuel user, the fuel costs. And so I just hope that it's inevitably that there's pushback on this, but then there's going to be pushback on every single thing we do on climate, because we can't do this stuff with people without people having to make some changes and choices. So that's what this is about.
What have been some of the other, I guess, big points for you that people will maybe have missed in this conversation around the most recent report and this final report from the Climate Change Commission? Because it's a very hefty document and hopefully going to be, I guess, a map for a pathway to deal with the climate crisis for the country. But what are some things that you think are significant that maybe have been missed in the media a little bit?
I think the overall tenor of the report's been missed. It is essentially what the Climate Commission has done is taken its draft proposals, got a lot of feedback, 15,500 submissions and all sorts of other inputs, and adjusted some of the things that it was over-optimistic on or perhaps pessimistic on. It hasn't responded to all. Obviously, it's made some decisions along the way. So what it's done, it's strengthened basically the case it laid out. And thus has made its final recommendations much more robust. But in that process, it did make some significant changes. So, for example, it had put too much emphasis on getting to a high proportion of electric vehicles in the fleet relatively quickly, and it's taken advice that, well, the supply might be a problem. Mm. So it's done something it should have done at the beginning, which is to put more emphasis on mode shift, i.e., we try to do things other than use cars, or if we use cars, have more than one person in them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's about walking, cycling, public transport, and the rest. The mode shift's very important because you get that's where you get the bigger changes and far quicker and at far lower capital cost than people going out and buying electric cars. And also a very big shift in forestry, whereby the commission has come out and articulated this very well, that we need to be planting more native trees because they have much longer life than exotic trees, but take longer to store carbon.
Mm.
So yes to exotics in the early years, but we need to do an awful lot more on natives and on permanent forests. The big complaint I had about it, the draft, and that nothing's changed in the final recommendations, is the Commission has completely missed nature-based solutions, which worldwide are considered roughly about a third of the response to the climate crisis. And planting trees is not the same as a nature-based solution.
So what is a nature-based solution? Yeah, what does that look like?
It's rebuilding ecosystems, because humankind is massively destroying ecosystems, which is our life support system. And there is the whole debate has shifted, and very powerful arguments and documents and research, particularly coming out this year, about how we have to tackle the biodiversity crisis, that loss of ecosystems and species, as part of solving, and indeed it's a tool for solving the climate crisis as well. And the big conference to keep an eye on is the United Nations Biodiversity Conference of the Parties, which is in Kunming, China in October. Now that's going to be COP 15 before we get to COP 26, the climate one in Glasgow in November. And the Climate Commission has bits of that, but it's far from articulate. And particularly on farming, it has swallowed absolutely hook, line, and sinker this really strange view from so-called farming leaders, that we're already the best in the world in terms of lowest carbon per kilogram of milk solids, etc. But there's nothing much more we can do about methane. So don't ask too much of us. And the Climate Commission's gone along with that. And that flies completely in the face of what major food companies are doing around the world, setting themselves really demanding net zero emissions targets and roadmaps to get there. And I think that the agricultural sector is leaving itself way behind what's going on in land use and farming and farming's response to the climate crisis elsewhere in the world.
Well, let's talk a little bit about land up north now. This has been an unfolding situation, and we're sort of at an impasse at the moment. This is in response to district plans from the Far North District Council in Kaikohe, where they have designated a very large amount of private land as a significant natural area, or an SNA, and that has caused massive backlash within the community, particularly from Māori. There was a hīkoi of about, I think, 1,500 people who basically went to the Kaikoura District offices to protest this action. And a lot of people are calling it a land snatch, another sort of action against the treaty obligations of Crown and Māori relations. This is a big conversation and perhaps one we haven't got time to get all the way into this morning. But what are some of your, I guess, initial responses to this? Because it is a part of a much broader picture.
It is, and it's absolutely the case of wrong process, but right goal. So the wrong process actually goes back to 1991 when the current Resource Management Act was brought in. Such areas were supposed to be designated, and they never have been properly in many parts of the country, and the far north being one of them. But we're just about to launch in, we're already along the way, to having a massive rework of the RMA into our National and Built Environments Act and then some allied acts alongside that. Which will treat these things differently. So it was a really serious mistake for the Far North District Council to plunge into this in the dying days of the RMA. But the goal of safeguarding these significant natural areas is hugely important because this goes back to ecosystems and the biodiversity issues I was talking about earlier. Mancare research shows that 84,000 hectares of native tussock shrubland and forest were cleared across New Zealand between 1996 and 2017, and most of that was on private land. So the thing is, we have to find a way to work with landowners, and particularly with Māori on this, to make sure that they feel in control of that process rather than just being simply mapped and dictated to by the district council. And so they can share... So on their land, they can help restore those ecosystems. And there's huge value in this. The concept of financial credits for building up biodiversity and other voluntary financial mechanisms is growing very rapidly. So these are taonga of a natural kind. That's their number one importance in life. But secondly, there is real benefit there for the people who are guardians of that land. And so when Federated Farmers said that these are rules being written by people who don't understand farming, I'd say, well, if that's how you feel, then farmers, you don't understand nature, because that's the importance of these places. And you can have a healthier farm if you safeguard the ecosystems on them and learn how to farm within those ecosystems. So that's all part of the big shift in agriculture going on worldwide. And so that's what's going on here. And we have wonderful examples of, for example, the care of the Tu'uruweras being given back to Tuhoi, or the Whanganui River having been given the right of personhood, legal standing in the courts. We're making huge progress on understanding and progress here, but what's going on, and that's what needs to happen in the far north. But the process was so ridiculously 1991 and the last gasp of the RMA as to be a really serious mistake. So I'm really glad that Robertson, Deputy Prime Minister, called for a halt on this when he was up in the far north just a few days ago. And James Shaw, who as Climate Minister, who's really articulate on these issues, is going up there to learn a lot more of what's going on up there. This is all good progress.
Well, thank you so much for your time this morning, Rod Oram. It's always great to have you on the show. We'll talk to you again in a few weeks, so be well until then.
Thank you. Stay well yourself. Take care.
Ka kite. Bye.
You just heard a bit of political commentary.